Welcome to Old Books of Grace. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Joy Clarkson onto the podcast to discuss one of my all-time favorite topics, metaphors and how they shape us. As a forever English major, I love figurative language, and this conversation was just delightful. Joy Clarkson is the author of Aggressively Happy and host of popular podcast Speaking with Joy. She's the books editor for Plow Quarterly and a research associate in theology and literature at King's College London. Joy completed her PhD in theology at the University of St. Andrews, where she researched how art can be a resource of hope and consolation. Joy loves daffodils, birdwatching, and a well-brewed cup of Yorkshire gold tea. You can learn more at joyclarkson.com. Welcome to Old Books with Grace. I'm so glad you're here, Joy. Your new book is a delight. Thank you for coming on.
I'm so happy to be back with you.
So you might remember this from last time, but the good news is that I don't remember your answers. So it's going to be just as exciting and new to me as if I have never asked you these questions before. The first get to know you question is, who or what is your favorite book or author from more than 50 years ago and why?
So I think last time I said Julian of Norwich because I think we kind of bonded over it and talked about it. So I think I will still say that. I think that she is warm and personable and, you know, obviously she's writing from her own time. And if you get any of that old English, which I'm sure you do, then you could tell it's from a long time ago. But there's also this real immediacy to it that it feels... Yeah. It feels very personal and like you could just be sitting having a conversation with her now. And so I just love it. I love the language she uses about being enclosed in God's love and, you know, the homely love of God. It's wonderful. It's personal. It's deep. You know, there's a lot of Augustine, I think, in Julian of Norwich, or at least people say that. And I think it's wonderful to be able to read the words of a fellow woman who is a Christian from so long ago who can speak so directly to me now.
I couldn't agree more. You're right. Now I do vaguely remember that we did bond over that last time. And I still agree. She's my favorite too. And I am one of those who feel like she has read Augustine. In my mind, her and Augustine are in a very similar category of you read what they write and you're like, this could have been written yesterday. Like, take away the historical context, and what you're saying is so deep into the heart of the human experience that it is timeless. It is absolutely timeless. It's a strange sensation, I think.
Well, there's something kind of like, you know, there's markers of their time in both of them. You get the Neoplatonism in Augustine. You get the, like, affective devotion stuff with Julian, but they're both also kind of phenomenological, by which I mean they're talking about their experiences of the world and their experiences of God. And I think those things are just kind of timeless. You know, they're not trying to, when you read them, you feel like you're talking human being to human being.
Yes, that's right. That's right. And I think that's actually a shockingly difficult quality to cultivate in writing in general, like of any age, of our age, of any age, is that quality of human to humanness and the honesty of it. So yeah, great answer. Can never go wrong. Okay, though, but number two, which literary character do you most identify with and why?
So I think I said Lizzie Bennet, but I'm going to change my answer this time and say maybe Harriet Vane in the Peter Rimsey series, specifically Gaudy Knight, which is like, I actually think is not that complimentary to me because Harriet Vane is like a lovable character, but she's a little bit like grouchy and like she's always kind of fighting her own, like she's feeling quite judgmental, but then she like kind of vaguely feels bad about feeling judgmental. And then she's, I think probably I most identify with her because she's kind of a writer in an academic world and she's trying to figure out where she fits in that world. Aww. And she's She wafts between being kind of acerbic and sharp, and then, but she's actually quite soft and needy, which I feel like many, I won't say which of those qualities are mine, but probably most of them.
You know, what's funny is that that's been an answer several times recently lately. And I think maybe that speaks to the kind of people whose work and whose writing I really like. Apparently I like Harriet Vane style people, and that's who I want to talk to a lot. So
yeah,
kind of funny.
There you go.
Lots of Dorothy Sayers fans out there, which is great. A good quality. So you've written this wonderfully accessible book on metaphor and its power in our lives called You Are a Tree. In each chapter, you dive into one ancient metaphor taken from scripture that sort of multiplies out into other works across time and into your daily life. You tell stories and it all makes me wonder why metaphor and what makes metaphor particularly special compared to other figurative speech, like simile is the obvious one my kids love at the dinner table, trying to argue about which is simile, which is metaphor. But like simile or allegory, why metaphor? Mm-hmm.
So metaphor, so I mean, if you're kind of a word nerd, you think about these things and they matter to you. And I would like to think that probably some of the people who listen to your podcast might not need too much convincing about metaphor being important.
No, but enlighten us nonetheless.
Yes.
Because I feel like one can never talk too much, be reminded too much about what aspects of our speech are important to us as humans.
So I'll tell a weird story, and I feel funny telling this because the tweet was not the motivation for this book at all. I've thought about metaphors for a very long time, but I had this funny experience a few years ago where I had been off of social media for the better part of a year because I was finishing my PhD. And then I had kind of been having this thought in my mind about how, well, I actually write in the book about how during my PhD, I had to kind of talk myself out of thinking of myself as a machine because I was making myself very exhausted and less productive by kind of orienting myself around rigid productivity and expecting the same thing of myself every day. And so I'd kind of been thinking about that. And so literally the first day after I got back from this year-long hiatus, I posted a tweet that was said something to the effect of like, you're not a machine, you're more like a garden. And then I talked about it and it went viral and there's no saying why these things go viral. I feel like sometimes the algorithm just picks random people for some reasons off random days. I don't feel like it was a particularly brilliant tweet, but it was funny because I just watched how much people reacted to that small shift in metaphor from thinking themselves as a machine that produces the same everything every day, that is mechanical, that's created to produce things, that just recharges. You should be able to plug it in, rest, and it should be back to normal in no time. How much shifting from that to thinking of themselves as a garden that needs cultivating, that needs something different every day, that has seasons that are more and less fruitful. Watching how people reacted to that on kind of like a mass level reflected my own experience, which is that we kind of unconsciously use metaphors all the time. And that those metaphors we use shape our expectations of things. So, you know, if I, another one that I talk about the book is kind of the metaphors we use for love and how many of them tend to be kind of like something unfortunate happening to you, like getting sick, falling, or having a madness take over, right? So you say you fall in love, you're crazy in love, you're crazy for her, you're lovesick, you know, all of these different, and that has great ancient roots in things like Plato, you know, that love is the divine madness. But if that's your metaphor that you're using consciously or unconsciously for love, then you have this expectation of what love is like, which is that love is like a disease. It kind of takes hold of you. It rips you out of your normal existence. It kind of makes you unable to cope in your normal way, but also it passes, right? Diseases kind of usually come and then they either kill you or eventually you get over them. Mm-hmm. And that's how a lot of people talk about love, right? Uh-huh. That you kind of, you catch feelings and then, you know, but if it's infatuation 10 years from now, you'll get over it. And if that's your expectation about love and the way that you talk about love embodies that metaphor, then you will proceed in a different way than if you described love as something like a home where you felt like you belonged, where you were safe, where you let someone in, but also kept out the bad things. Mm-hmm. So I'm giving a very rambly answer, but I do think the metaphors we use shape kind of how we engage with life. And I think the reason that they do that particularly more than similes, so to put on our nerdy English hats for the moment, a simile is something that compares like with like, right? So in the book, I talk about Bobby Burns's "My love is like a red, red rose that sweetly blooms in June." And that's a simile because it's marking the similarity. So my mm-hmm. love is like a red, red rose. So there are qualities the rose has that my love also has, you know, bean. A metaphor is when you say my love is a red rose or as I talk about the Billy Collins poem where he talks about the love being the dew in the morning grass and the baker's apron. And I think that they are distinctive because I think they do something a little bit more complicated. They invite us to give an actual form, right? It's not just saying that there's qualities in this thing like love that is also in disease. It's like it gives love a form, right? Mm-hmm. This kind of nameless, shapeless thing that we call love is then given a form that we can look at and ponder around and in a way that's more kind of imaginatively, there's more imaginative potential in it than I think just a simile. And I think there's also, and I talk about this, an element in metaphor where there's always like a breakdown in metaphor. So, mm-hmm. you know, people are trees. But when we say that, we also know that people are in fact not trees, right? Mm-hmm. And that kind of the cognitive dissonance in a metaphor, if we're conscious of it, it makes us want to pay more attention because we want to notice all the ways in which we are like trees, but also kind of break open and note how we're not. And so I think that metaphor, when used well, gives us this kind of attitude of attention towards the world and an awareness that the words we use, whether they're metaphors or similes, are never sufficient to cover the thing we're talking about. Mm. That was a very long answer.
No, that was wonderful. No, I love it. I love it. What I was thinking about as you were talking too, was that in simile, there's an element of distance. When you use the like or as, there's a distance there. And metaphor brings it in so close, as you were saying, giving it form. But that when we're speaking, that there's this distance there or a lack of distance, that will totally influence how we understand and conceptualize something. And so if something's a little more removed from us, a simile, that's more of the realm of the simile. But when it's really close, sometimes so close that we don't even recognize we're using a metaphor, which is what you were pointing to earlier with our attitudes about love, for instance. And I find that so interesting how that just that little tweak makes such a big difference in some of our inner workings. And so that actually relates to this next question, which you've already kind of answered, but maybe we could just talk a little more about it, which is that how we use metaphors all the time. And your example that you bring up a lot in the book is like computer or computing or machine metaphors, and how we use them unconsciously. I'm recharging, I'm processing this, et cetera, et cetera. But, our use is often thoughtless or even unconscious, it still affects how we think of ourselves and how we think specifically of the life of human flourishing, which is a big part of what you're exploring in your book is how metaphors help us understand human flourishing, right? So what's at stake in becoming more conscious of how we use metaphor? Is there some like concrete things that really come out of this abstract change in language?
It was funny. I was on the interview yesterday for like a morning show, and the host was like, what would you practically tell people to do coming away from this book? And I kind of rambled and I was like, well, look at a tree and see how it goes through seasons and then think about your interior life and wonder what season you're in. And I was like, I'm giving the answer that I just gave to what is the practical thing you could take away from this book is to look at trees and think about your interior life. And on some level, that is the answer that I want to give.
I mean, is that such a bad thing? That's pretty good, I'd say.
But I think that I really do believe, and I think this is not just my personal conviction, but it is true that the metaphors we use shape how we live. And there's a great book called Metaphors We Live by Lakoff and Johnson. I think it's George Lakoff and Mark Johnson. I always get their names mixed up, something like that. But it's from cognitive psychologists about how pretty much all of language is metaphorical. It's right. Kind of impossible to get away from metaphorical language. And I think one of the particular, and maybe we'll talk about this in a minute, one of the particular kind of ailments of the time that we currently live in is that we think that it's possible to speak without metaphors. We yes. think it's possible to speak literally.
Yes.
And
getting back to the machines, right? I mean, part yes. of it is that we think that we can, and the funny thing is that since we're teaching the machines language, it's not even like they can escape metaphor, but we think we confuse that, wow, this is logic, hard facts, concrete, yes. whatever, versus yeah. lovey-dovey art stuff out in space.
But what's funny is that, and you described that, and you described it in a way that I think a hard rationalist would. You said it's logic, it's hard facts, right? That's a metaphor because it's metaphor. Talking about
Absolutely.
Something that's solid versus something that's soft. And the reality is that all of our language is metaphorical mm-hmm. and that the less we are aware of that, the more our metaphors are just unconscious. Mm-hmm. And so the more we're being influenced by unconscious things. And I think that that is particularly true when it comes to things like I talk about in the book, money and machine metaphors. And I think the reason that we use those metaphors is that kind of modern, you know, to be very academic, ivory tower about it, you know, we live in a modern capitalistic society. Right. And so we are, you know, you and I are talking through two machines into mm-hmm. our little machines, you know, our microphones into our laptops. And I'm looking at my phone, which is over to the right of my laptop, and my AirPods that are here. And so we're surrounded by machines everywhere we look. And so it makes sense that we reach for, linguistically, that we reach for machines when we're trying to describe things, because they are the tangible, visible things that we spend the most time with.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is, and I think that's also true of money. I've been thinking a lot lately about how much we describe relationships in terms of money. And that makes sense because money is an expression of value, but,
and to complicate things, it is also a scriptural metaphor too. Redemption
yes,
is a monetary theme.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. I think the problem is never like when we use a metaphor, it's when it becomes unconscious and totalizing, you know, when it becomes,
yes,
because that's one metaphor amongst many, right? When we talk about the metaphor of redemption for salvation. That's a metaphor, but there's also the metaphor of being washed. There's also the metaphor
yes.
of being rescued. There's also the metaphor of a courtroom.
Yes.
So there's lots of different options. So I think with machines specifically, what is at stake is that we treat life as though it's something that can be calculated, replicated, and is oriented towards production,
mm-hmm.
right? So if I think about machines, I want them to act the same way every day. Their purpose is functional, literally, mm-hmm. right? Like mm-hmm. I, on some level, it's nice that my computer exists, but I don't really think my computer needs to exist, you know, in and for itself. It is for a purpose, which is to accomplish things for me. And I want it to do that. And it's kind of self-existing that it, you know, it needs to be plugged in, but for the most part, it doesn't need to go socialize with other computers.
Mm-hmm.
And the more that we kind of absorb that language for ourselves and unconsciously use the recharging processing, the more we think, well, maybe human beings are made for a function. They're made to mm-hmm. contribute to society. They're made to be productive. They are replaceable, right? If you mm-hmm. break a computer, you just put another computer in. And they should, we should be able to expect a consistency of them. We should be able to, you know, replace parts with them. And that's just not how human beings are. I think that a Christian vision of human beings is that they are valuable.
Yes.
Just because they reflect the image of God before they did anything, before they contribute anything, after they mess everything up, like human beings are just valuable. And also, human beings are not the same every day. Like, it is simply the case that it is a less appropriate metaphor for human beings because we just recharge, right? We go through different seasons. We're always changing and evolving. Sometimes we're more or less productive because we're a different age. You know, when I was a single college student, I could do a lot more than I can as a slightly older, you know, person with more responsibilities and connections and also less energy. And mm-hmm. that's just a part of being a human being. And so what's at stake, I think, is that we miss much of the mystery of the world, that we treat ourselves and other people with a greater harshness, and that we become a little bit less humane.
Yeah. Yeah. And I appreciate your pointing out that it's can be a very useful metaphor nonetheless, but that what's at stake is that intentionality with it and how much it's affecting our own vision for human fullness, which is lovely and important to be intentional about our language in that way. And I think something that, again, to be a medievalist for just a sec, something that we easily flatten out language in the age of computers. We easily diminish it. And so metaphor doesn't let us do that. It always points at this sort of power and shaping beneath language that we can ignore really easily. And so something that I've been ever more convinced of, and in my recent book, Jesus Through Medieval Eyes, I think about metaphor a lot. And I think about how the people of the past used it specifically. And I come away inevitably with the impression that they were, generally speaking, obviously this is a general level, far more into metaphor and figural language in general and more intentional about it and more conscious of it than we are today. And I wondered if you, because you draw on a lot of the works on the past in this book too, if you feel that way, if you feel that same way, and if yes, how can we learn from these folks of the past?
I definitely feel that way. And if I put on my scholarly cap about it, I'm never sure how much I actually agree with the whole kind of secularization theory, like as a totalizing theory, but there are kind of generalizations that people make about how I think a big part of why what we might call a pre-modern, early modern person uses metaphor more is that they see, you know, Charles Taylor talks about secularity as involving several things. And one of the main ones is the buffered self. Mm. And what he means by that is that there's a strong distinction between me, which is interior, and the world, which is exterior. Mm-hmm. And there's a division. Somehow we are, me and the world are separate. But I think that for the medieval person, you could tell me this better than I could, but my understanding, at least from a theological point of view, is the sense that there is a integral relationship between the exterior material world and me, that there's not some kind of separation. And so, you know, I think about like Hildegard of Bingen, who thinks about the microcosm and the macrocosm, that human beings are this microcosm. We're this little universe that everything... It's this wonderful idea that she has, that everything in the world can be found in the human being. So that there's this kind of reciprocity between what is outside and what is inside. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes with this sense, which is another element of secularism, according to Taylor, which is the sense that the world is a shepherded, created place with an inherent integrity that can reveal something about spiritual life.
Yes.
And the sense
Bonaventure's great idea that, you know, everywhere you look, everything has an aspect of God in it. Everything is reflecting that God to you if you can see it.
If you can pay attention, yeah. And so I think that those two assumptions in my mind are why they were more attentive to metaphor, was the sense, A, that there's not this radical separation between me and the world, that what is outside has a relationship to what is inside because God made the world and he made me a part of it. And even in some way, human beings are these little microcosms in the macrocosm of this universe. And also that because of that, there is this kind of integrity to the natural world and to all of our experiences in it that I think the language Bonaventure uses is like they're little mirrors of God. Mm-hmm. And so what can we have to learn from them? So I got into this real weird Barfield kick, which I, by the way, I finished the article. The last time I was talking to you, I was writing the Piranesi article about Barfield and German, and I just need to submit it now. So it is done.
But by the way, pause. Piranesi is like, I feel like, I know you don't talk about it in this book, but it would be a great fiction and nonfiction companion with one another for any book clubs out there, just throwing it out there. That would be really fun and interesting to do it that way. Anyways, keep going.
That would be fun. Anyway, but Barfield has this whole idea basically that like on some level you kind of needed to move away from the metaphorical way of thinking to pay more attention to things for like scientific progress.
Mm.
But that none of the scientific progress actually denies the kind of perspective that the, you know, medieval mind had.
Right.
And that really, if we were to adopt, and this is kind of what I hope the book does in some ways, that we've just kind of developed what Barfield calls a habit of inattention, that we just don't attend to the world in the same way anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And that, that maybe if we trusted that there was kind of something beyond the phenomenon, beyond just the kind of things we see, that we might actually discover that there is this integrity and this richness, this communicativeness about our everyday experiences. And so in a funny way, I told one of my friends when I was writing the book, you know, you have lofty goals when you're writing a book, whether or not you accomplish them. And I said, one of the things I want the book to be more than anything else is just, I want it to be beautiful or at least have beautiful moments. And so I tried in every chapter to actually meditate on the experience that we get these metaphors from. So the experience of watching a tree go through its seasons or the experience of watching a sunrise, because I want to believe that I think the thing we can learn from the medievals is that there are metaphors furnished for us in the world that do reveal something about our spiritual life, and what the to put it into a money metaphor, the kind of the currency that we pay to get those is attention.
Yes. Yeah. I love that. That's great. And I think very true. So you cover all kinds of metaphors. It's really lovely. I love how you do that by reflecting on both the created world where the metaphor is coming from and draw in literary and theological meditations and musings. Was there a metaphor that you changed your feelings about as you wrote, or one that particularly affected you?
So I think the one that particularly affected me was actually thinking about sadness as heaviness and burden, because I realized it was actually really helpful for me to think about like externalizing sadness as something that's not integral to me, but something outside of me that I can think about and carry and ask other people to help me with. And that I really enjoyed thinking about that. And also kind of change is birth, which is woven into the creation is birth chapter. The sense that the best and biggest things in our lives require something like birth, which is always a little bit terrifying. And it's always a beginning as well as an ending. And kind of having some language for that was really meaningful to me. I was also just really gobsmacked by wisdom is light. Once I started to notice it, I was like, oh my gosh, it's in like all of the language we use for wisdom and for knowledge. And then just realizing how much immense literature there is all throughout history on that idea of wisdom is light was kind of mind-boggling. And so that one was, I felt like I learned a lot with that one. Whereas I feel like the birth was very satisfying to be able to have language for that kind of change. And then sadness was really helpful in a practical way, I think.
I think it's so wonderful. One of my professors in grad school used to really like emphasize this in teaching, but how wonderful it is that you have an idea in writing, but then writing it actually expresses it, and you were, and it wasn't that you even thought it, but then you wrote it and you were like, oh, I have now made sense to myself about something, which I just think is the most wonderful, strange mystery in the world with writing, where you're like, oh, okay, so I was thinking about this, and somehow I have now articulated it in a way that has illuminated
yes,
my own inner self to me, which is so crazy, actually.
It is. And I don't know if you find this, but sometimes I will like write something and then I won't look at it for a long time. And then I'll be thinking about it again and trying to come to it. And I'll remail writing. I'll be like, oh, I already made sense of it. I just forgot.
Yes, absolutely. I have definitely done that. And then it's always a nice experience when that happens. Cause sometimes you read stuff that you've written and you're like, huh,
what?
Okay. How about that? But then other times
she was trying.
She was trying, you know, she was trying so hard. Good for her.
Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, that's really wonderful. I just love that. So, okay, is there a metaphor that you didn't have space to include, but that you wish you had included?
Yes. I was thinking about that a couple days ago. I think I would have liked to do a chapter on water. Because I think that's a pretty ancient metaphor, as something which both cleans and gives life, and it's just related to so many things. It's related to being washed, to being watered, to being given birth to. So I wish I could have done a chapter on water.
Yeah, it is a metaphor of both life and death, which is pretty crazy when you think about it, that it encompasses both those things. Yeah. Maybe you'll have to do one for fun sometime. Just
yeah.
For a future edition, if it all works out. Okay, and so I have one last question for you, which is that metaphors, of course, have been a part of different languages, different religions, different times and places. They're just human. They're a human thing. But you suggest at the end of You Are a Tree that there's something particularly Christian about metaphor, that the Christian life is also a metaphor. What do you mean by that? And can you tell us more?
So I will get nerdy a little bit to describe this, although good. I don't think I have to get that nerdy. So the technical definition of metaphor is usually taken from Aristotle, where he talks about kind of to metaphor, the metaphor in Greek, I'm having a moment, is literally means kind of to carry over. So it's to carry over the properties from one thing to another thing, right? So it's to carry over the properties of a tree to me. And the direction of transference, it's all very technical, tends to run from the thing that the properties properly belong to. So a tree properly has branches and leaves and seasons and all those things. And I transfer those to me, maybe doesn't more properly have those things. So when I say that the Christian life is a metaphor, what I mean is that the properties that make us Christian, you know, when we become Christ-like, they are borrowed from the place where they originally belong, which is in God. They are transferred to us in salvation, in baptism. There's something that we kind of borrow from God and participate in, so that our whole life becomes this kind of transference from the life of God, wherein goodness and love and wisdom and creativity all most properly dwell. And in the Christian life, as we learn to grow and to become more like God, those are given to us, that we kind of become these living metaphors. And one of the ways I talk about that is it's in the final chapter on life as a journey. And I talk about how Augustine uses this kind of language of pilgrimage throughout all of his writing as his kind of fundamental metaphor, by which he both means kind of traveling. I was thinking about this today. I had coffee with a friend and she said, I don't think that's the direction I'm going. And I thought, oh, it's a journey metaphor. So he uses it in the sense that we're always going from one place to another. We're traveling through time, but also the sense that we are exiles, that we never feel quite at home in this world. And I talk about how even the word home is interesting, because when we use the word home, we all have a home in mind, but there's not like, usually when you're using a metaphor, there's a concrete thing that you're describing, that you're bringing to an abstract concept. But I think in our experience, when I talk about home, I'm thinking of a place that shares all the qualities of something I've never quite experienced. Mm. So there's this sense that even the homes we experience in this world are kind of a living metaphor of the home that we fundamentally desire.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I meant by us being living metaphors, that we borrow the properties of Christ, and that in doing that, we become a living metaphor, and that we, in this journey through life, kind of long for the home that all the homes we experience in this life are a metaphor of, that they borrow their properties from that heavenly home. Mm. And that we have this kind of movement towards and a return to the place that gives us the origin of our being.
I think Augustine would approve.
I hope so.
Well, thank you so much for sharing with us about your tree and thinking about metaphor and its place in our language and its power in our imagination. I really appreciate it. Where can folks find you online if they're interested in finding out more about what you're up to?
So my headquarters at the moment, which I think yours are as well, are on Substack. Mm-hmm. So if you just go to Joy Clarkson, I think it's joyclarkson.substack, whatever. Google Joy Clarkson, Substack, it'll come up. I think joyclarkson.com redirects there. And then I'm on, I won't say all the social medias, but I'm on a few of them. So I'm on, I'm on Facebook, sometimes Instagram often, and, the website currently, formerly known as Twitter, less often than I used to be, cause it's just become less fun.
Yeah.
But you can find me in all those places.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm so glad you could come on. And I just am excited about your book.
Thank you for having me. It's always a delight.
Thanks for listening to Old Books with Grace. I'm Dr. Grace Hammond. And if you'd like to find me online, you can find me on Twitter/X, whatever we call it these days, at Grace Hammond, PhD. Or you can find me on Instagram at Old Books with Grace. Or you can find me on Substack, where I write a monthly newsletter called Medievalish with Grace Hammond, which explores some of the things I've been reading and really interested in medieval and early modern literature. And if you enjoyed this podcast episode, I'd really appreciate it if you left a rating and review on your podcasting platform. Thanks again for listening, and I'll see you next time.